welcome to our new PR Week podcast episode with Arvind Hickman.
Hello, I'm Arvind Hickman, and welcome to the PR Show. Today, I'm joined by W Communications founder Warren Johnson to discuss some of the bigger picture issues taking place in the PR and media industries. Warren has strong views on how social media companies are currently behaving in relation to media relations and their ongoing regulatory battles around the world. His agency W has also just launched a new venture to help restaurants survive during COVID and is well placed to give us a rundown on how the new lockdown restrictions timeline set by Boris Johnson could impact the PR industry. Welcome back to the program, Warren. How are you going?
Thanks, Arvind. Great to be back. Looking forward to our chat.
Fantastic. Now, Warren and I have had many chats over the years about social media and what's currently going on. And he has some pretty strong views, including the situation in Australia and about big tech disbanding their PR teams and not engaging with the media. Warren, would you like to elaborate on some of your key points?
I would, although quite often these views are sometimes delivered after a glass of wine, Arvind. So hopefully they'll be a little bit less libelous. But yes, I mean, there's been a bunch of stuff that's caught my eye recently, all of which providing, I guess, some ongoing dim view of big tech. There was a story that ran last week in the Times about a general disengagement of big tech with editorial media, disbanding their press office. In fact, it even said that Tesla had completely disbanded their press office. And big tech sort of seemingly deciding that they don't like the scrutiny of a sort of free press, and a lot of them choosing to bypass engagement for fear of not being held to account, and publishing their own platforms directly. And I think if you add this to the fact that they're selling on editorial news themselves as per the and not remunerating the content producers as per the sort of landmark case in Australia, added with the fact of them actually pulling out their own advertising budgets on other platforms over the course of the year, it certainly paints a picture of them somewhat bottom feeding, I think sort of taking as much out as possible, and then really refusing to put anything back in. And then when you add that to their kind of tax regime as well, it paints a fairly consistent picture about their behaviour.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's been a lot of conjecture about this in recent times. In terms of them sort of disbanding their press offices, can you sort of share a few more details about what that Times article said and what you were aware of?
Yeah, it was talking about the fact that, there was a quote from in a Danny Forston piece about them talking about... there's a quote here saying, you know what, it's not worth the trouble, we're out. The lack of fact-checking, link-baiting headlines and picking asideism. It sounds like they're describing themselves rather than editorial media. But there's certainly the guys at Anderson Horowitz are looking to increasingly disconnect and ironically decline to comment for this very piece. But they're looking to start to create their own direct-to-consumer channels so that there's a less scrutiny and less being held to account.
It's an interesting development, isn't it? I mean, they probably would argue that they are getting quite a tough time in the media of late in recent years, particularly companies like Facebook, which seem to be generating negative headlines on a regular basis.
They would be right. There's been this sort of, relentless sort of 15-year fanboyism of particularly a lot of US editorial media on everything Silicon Valley does, which I think has sort of, lulled them into a false sense of security. And it's great to see news media waking up and giving these guys a bit more of the same scrutiny that everyone else is under, and the fact that, not everything they do is perfect. And I think that, rather than them feeling victimized, they need to understand that they have to have a greater level of ethics, given their, unprecedented power and scale. It's great they're being held to account. And I think rather than them getting in a mood with editorial media, I think there's a bit of soul searching needs to be undertaken.
It's quite interesting as well, because while they may be sort of disassembling their press office function and not really engaging with the media, at the same time, they're sort of bulking up their lobbying efforts, aren't they? Especially with governments around the world that are looking to impose regulations.
Massively, massively so. And certainly some of the coverage I read about the Murdoch Facebook piece in Australia was a sense that perhaps they may well, you know, bow to pressure in the way that Google did, just really not to pay news media properly, but actually as an attempt to avoid any further regulation. Yeah, I'd seen a piece, you're right, Arvind, that I think that their level of lobbying in Brussels and Washington is you know, spectacular in its scale, showing that, you know, certainly lobbying is very far from presenting a kind of balanced worldview. So it would indicate that there's very much a kind of, you know, a one-track mind in terms of, rather than amending their behaviour, getting everyone to bend to see things their way rather than them making any changes. So I think the increase in lobbying shows an increasing lack of willingness to, you know, change how they behave.
And what's really interesting about it as well is the fact that they, you know, when they were trying to sort of put on the charm offensive over the years with the media and that sort of backfired, not sort of being transparent and accountable in many ways, it sort of goes against what they're trying to achieve, isn't it? We just try to win the hearts and minds of people.
Yeah, although they've kind of, I mean, I'm not certain they have won hearts and minds. I think they've bought hearts and minds, and it's now, you know, they've been so brilliant at what they've done in terms of infiltrating, you know, the world. I mean, certainly Zuckerberg is the sort of, you know, presides over the biggest empire sort of in history with his sort of 2.6 billion users. And I think, I'm not sure there's much love, but I think what a lot of big tech have done is they've moved from being, you know, brands, businesses into, you know, monopolistic utilities. So hearts and minds almost don't matter when you have your tentacles attached into people's daily lives.
It's a really good point. And I do want to ask you a bit about some of the regulation efforts that are happening around the world. What's your take on what's happening in Australia with the new media code and asking these platforms to pay media companies more? Because there's sort of two sides to that argument, isn't there? I mean, they're arguing that they shouldn't have to pay for publishers to provide their links on their platforms because publishers are benefiting from that. But publishers are arguing that they're also taking a large, you know, slice of their pie and that the value exchange hasn't been in their favour for many years now.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I'll apologise in advance for not being super privy to the nuance of all of that, but I think on a bigger picture, they have, the rise of digital has obviously decimated news production, and there's going to come a point where if they don't help fund any of those, even regardless of what the commercial and moral or legal case is, there'll come a point where if those news outlets are not funded in other ways, then their output will diminish even further. So I think it's, you know, if in the same way that if we all feel that a free, vibrant, well-funded press is a good thing, which we all do, we've all got to pay for it in some way, shape or form as consumers. I think that, you know, businesses such as Facebook and Google have to take on that view as well. So even if they don't necessarily agree with it, I think it's, you know, having them funding journalism out of their, you know, spectacular coffers is hardly ever going to be really an issue for them financially, and will only be a better thing for society.
Okay, what's sort of the upshot for PR and comms? Is it getting to the case where journalism is in such a perilous state, particularly in some countries where it's very concentrated, Australia being one of those, where, you know, they're going to look more towards digital channels and towards sort of owned media rather than earned media? Are you starting to see those sorts of shifts? Have they been happening for a while?
I mean, I think you only need to look at the pagination of any papers you pick up these days to show that there's a massive, you know, reduction. I mean, we still represent a number of print-based businesses. So I'm a huge believer of them. I still have, you know, newspapers delivered to my doorstep every day. And I think it's hugely important. I think the funding model needs to change. And I think increasingly brands through the lens of earned and editorial media can look at alternative funding models to keep these products alive. I think from a PR industry, though, I think that there are huge growth opportunities above and beyond traditional editorial media. And as brands do seem to want to communicate directly to audiences via other platforms, I think the PR industry is well placed to work with, you know, some displaced journalists to create a kind of new hybrid model, which has the, you know, quality and integrity of editorial journalism, but allowed brands to, you know, to communicate, you know, at scale and at length to their audiences in new and interesting ways.
I'm just curious to hear what clients think about this at the moment. Has there been sort of a bit of a push away from traditional media in some of the briefs that you're getting?
Yes and no. I mean, what's ironic actually is that whenever we talk to big tech or Silicon Valley, that the thing they value most is you know, full page articles in broadsheet newspapers in print. You know, so there's still a huge kite mark of credibility and authenticity that comes from landing a really solid piece of coverage in a quality print title, because it's just bloody difficult and there's not much pagination to go around. So when something runs, you know, it really validates the client and their brand and whatever particular campaign or initiative it is. So that, you know, that's been the same since I started in PR in the mid-90s. Having said that, though, what we're starting to see, though, is, you know, PR being bundled into multiple briefs. So we're seeing a lot more briefs which refer to as, you know, PR, social and influencer. And I think that hybrid of those three things coming together, being driven by sort of earned media mentality, is a trend we're seeing on the rise.
Okay. Another question I actually wanted to ask you in terms of getting into newspapers and getting coverage. One of the things that people tell me, especially in the past year with COVID happening, is that it's now a lot more difficult to get hold of journalists, and it's a lot more difficult to get into earned media placements. What's your sort of take on that? Have you noticed that as well?
Totally. I mean, you know, the fact is that, you know, journalists have been furloughed as well. They're working from home. They're not in newsrooms. There is less pagination. And there's COVID, which seems to dominate every page. So it's, you know, trying to get lighthearted stories away or feel good stories, or often the type of things that are a bit more brand centric, is, you know, there's fewer people writing about fewer things that are relevant for brands. So yeah, it's tough. It's tough. And I think that hopefully, I think we're all probably sick of reading about COVID. It's strange as well, because the more the media talk it up, the more their ad sales go down. So I think the, you know, one department needs to speak to the other department, maybe in a bit more detail. I think we're hoping, I can see the sun shining outside. Boris has announced only another 100 days, whatever we're left of you know, self-isolation. So I think that as the restrictions lift, I'm hoping that we'll see greater opportunities, journalism bouncing back, a change in the media narrative, and all of those. I think once we start opening up, once there are opportunities for consumers to do things, I think brands are going to play a tremendous role in that.
Okay, that's kind of a good point to segue into our next section, which sort of looks at Boris's announcement and the fact that there's, you know, another 100 days or so till things properly open up. What was your sort of reaction to that announcement?
I mean, on a personal level, my heart sank. You know, it's you know, it's just too long to be. I think it's going to kill the economy. I can't go out and be inspired by travel or culture, or, you know, it's a long time. It's a long, long time. We have a lot of travel clients. We have a lot of hospitality clients. You know, it's going to kill them. I can't see, you know, we were hoping that certainly in those two areas, and certainly in the arts as well, that there might be some sort of opportunity to recover this year. And I can't see that happening now, because they're going to, you know, there's half a year of trading really by the time we all get back out with restrictions, plus God knows what else. So, you know, if we'd done all this last year, you know, we'd be, you know, at concerts and cricket matches like the Aussies now. So I feel like this has been dragged out and poorly managed. I think the only thing that Boris has done well is finally got around to, you know, under-promising and over-delivering. So I'd imagine those are probably long dates, and they might be opening up a bit sooner. But it's terrible for big chunks of business. And certainly, you know, for, you know, a mental well-being, I think, is, you know, this has just gone on for a really long time, and I think that that's a bigger issue than COVID now, frankly.
Is that something that you're concerned about in terms of your own colleagues?
Completely. You know, everything from, you know, my kids doing more and more homeschooling through to, you know, people being cooped up at home for months on end with very little daylight. I mean, it's really tough. And we're, you know, as a manager of a business, it's an extra thing to have to manage, which as ever, there's no government support on. Which is, you know, forcing people being locked down. There's no subsidies there's no additional help that's being provided on that. So it's yet another thing that business have to manage. And it's tough, you know, we've got young kids in their first jobs who are in, you know, cooped up in flat shares in the middle of the winter. It's really tough. It's really tough. And it's something that is paramount for us, which is how to keep motivating people and keeping them positive. So we've adopted very much kind of like a light touched little and often thing rather than a few grand gestures. We're trying to almost on a sort of daily basis, trying to find ways to, you know, offer a bit of lightness in people's working days.
Okay. So, well, let's talk about some of the other impacts. You've mentioned the sort of mental health and sort of the people management side of things. What are some of the other broader business impacts of this new timeline that you think could happen, I guess, to W, but also more broadly to other agencies?
I mean, for me, we had a really great 6 months. The last 6 months have been really strong. We've really seen a softening now. And I think it's going to be a really tough 3 months for the industry. I think a lot of people were expecting budgets to recover in the next, you know, certainly at the start of Q2, and that's not going to happen. I think a lot of businesses that were, you know, hanging on by a thread, still leveraging furlough a bit. Certainly there's been a number of well-reported and quite high-profile businesses going under. I would expect to see another smaller, but still significant wave of, you know, businesses quietly closing up shop over the next few months, because I think it's tough. I think certainly anyone exposed to retail, hospitality, travel are really, you know, heavily, are going to struggle to, you know, stay afloat.
Mm. What about in terms of offices and rent? Is the government, do you know if the government is providing any sort of security or support?
Of course not. They didn't do anything like that to help. No, I mean, we've been paying full whack on our rent, you know, for the last, you know, 13 months or whatever, or 12 months of lockdown. And, you know, the landlords have behaved despicably across the board. Ours particularly are, you know, just dreadful, won't move on anything. We're the only people left in our building and they still won't give us any flex on rent. I think there's a lot of people that have really profiteered from this, and I think they're going to get their comeuppance. You just need to walk up and down Oxford Street and just see that the shop's boarded up, you know, on Oxford Circus itself, you know, the whole sort of top shop, top man corner is barricaded up because they're obviously fearful of looting and people aren't going to rush back to take up those spaces. So I think retail and offices are tough. I think there's, you know, there's going to be some more sophisticated, much more agile, flexible office space providers, that sort of office space 2.0, or so it's like co-working 2.0, which I think will work in collaboration with. But I think, you know, the traditional office model of that sort of adversarial relationship with landlords is going to have to go over. You know, having said that, I believe in the office. We're actually looking at increasing our office space as we grow. So we're expecting to move this summer. And, you know, I think I really believe in human interaction. So, of course, we'll offer some sort of flex. But this, you know, we're not going to entertain the idea of, you know, significant amounts of time being spent at home. I don't think it's not good for creativity. It's not good for collaboration. It's certainly not good for mental health.
Okay. You mentioned that you've got plans to move in the summer. Any ideas whereabouts you're looking?
Yeah, just around the corner. I can't say where, but yeah, we'll stay in W1. For us, it's really important. I think that as restrictions lift and as people sort of, you know, start to want to socialise together, I think a lot of big clients will be still prohibiting people from working. I think we're expecting to be a bit of a magnet for people to come in and collaborate, and I think we'll really benefit from that. I'm really thinking there's going to be a sort of two-pronged industry where there'll be a lot of people that stay away, and I think that will work. But I think that will be much more of a lifestyle business. I'm just a really big believer in this industry, spending time together. And I think anyone that does that will allow their business to accelerate quickly out of this.
Okay. Well, we're talking about business performance. Our top 150 is coming up relatively soon. We're getting a stream of figures coming in. What sort of expectations do you have for how the market has performed? What are you expecting to see with that report this year?
Good question. Our numbers are up year on year, which we're really proud of. A very mixed bag. I'd imagine some of the networks have really struggled. I think people that are able to be agile have probably done well. I'd imagine some of the bigger independents would have probably performed very well. There'll obviously be some specialists that have done increasingly well, those exposed to tech. I think it'll be a really, really fascinating reading. Just to see who's up and who's down, and who's not there anymore is probably will be the big story.
Okay. A final question, and I wanted to end this on a slightly positive note, but this week you launched a new incubator to have a hospitality business called Counter Service. Yep. Can you give a bit of a rundown on what Counter Service is, why you've launched it, and why now?
Great, yes, good question. It's effectively an agency within an agency. We've always done restaurants ever since I invested and helped launch Meat Liquor in nearly 10 years ago now. And we've always had, food culture at the heart of what we do. I've got a lot of very, very, very dear friends that have worked really hard to build really thriving restaurant businesses, and have seen a lot of them decimated. But they still, a lot of the really good ones won't let go, and they're still in the game. And it's really a commitment to help grow, help our friends and family and people we don't know yet within hospitality relaunch at a time where cash flow is really critical. So we've done very well out of that industry. It's our opportunity to give back. So we're kind of kickstarting with £100,000 worth of free hours, whether that's direct publicity time or mentoring from me. And then that will segue into a standalone agency that's really dedicated to service the new post-COVID needs of the hospitality business. We've already got some clients that sit within there who have strangely performed quite well during lockdown, people like Pizza Pilgrims, who evolved their entire business model, and we've PR'd them all the way through. So we're expecting to have some of our old restaurant clients to sit in there, and also some of the new ones coming in. But we're not looking to take any money for the next few months, because it's really important for us, both professionally but also personally, to get UK hospitality back on its feet. We want to be out in pubs and restaurants and bars having fun, and we want it to make it as easy as possible for those guys to reopen successfully.
Okay, fantastic. Well, I'm afraid that's all we have time for today. Thank you so much for joining us, Warren. It's always a pleasure.
Likewise, Arvin. Lots and lots of fun. Hopefully we'll get to see each other in real life soon.
We will. And thank you all for listening. I'd also like to thank our production partners, Marketeers, for helping produce the PR Show. If you found this podcast interesting, please do visit our website, prweek.com/UK, and support our journalism. Until next time, I'm Arvin Hickman. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to the PR Show podcast with Arvin Hickman. Brought to you by PR Week. If you like what you heard, please leave us a nice review.